This is Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross. And Dr. Melissa Rice, you have to be pretty excited.
Oh, my gosh, I'm excited. And I'm more than anything, I'm relieved that we have a robot on Mars.
Dr. Melissa Rice is a professor of geology at Western Washington University. You've been involved in all three of these Mars rover missions. And your job is to do what exactly?
Well, I have a couple of roles on this mission. I'm part of the MASCAM-Z team. MASCAM-Z are the two eyes on top of the rover's mast. These are the scientific cameras that are going to allow us to zoom into things on the distant horizon and take panoramic color images. I'm going to be part of that team operating the science cameras on the surface of Mars. Mm-hmm. And I have another role, which is called the long-term planner. So I'm part of a small group that herds the cats, if you will. We help the science team, which is 450 scientists working on this mission, we help direct the discussions that the team needs to have in order to make big decisions about where the rover is going to drive and what rocks it's going to drill into.
Well, let's talk about geology, because it landed in a dry lake bed, essentially. And the idea is that that is the most likely place where you'd find indications of past life forms. So tell me about this region, why it was chosen.
We chose this spot, Jezero Crater, exactly for that reason, because it looks like this was the spot where there was, at some point in Mars's history, a big lake filled with water. And there's a big river valley flowing into this ancient crater lake. It's dry now, but it looks like somewhere between 3.5 and 4 billion years ago, this would have been a place where a river was bringing water and sediments into a lake and building a big river delta, something like the Mississippi Delta, right there in the middle of Jezero Crater. We've landed right next to that delta, and we're going to be driving up to it and studying those rocks.
Okay, so what would life look like? What would be the indicators?
We're not looking for little green men. We don't expect to see a dinosaur bone sticking up out of the ground. What we're looking for when we look for life on Mars is evidence for ancient microbes. The period in Mars's history when Mars would have been habitable, when there could have been life swimming around in these lakes, was a relatively short period. And so if life did arise on Mars, it didn't have that much time to evolve into multicellular organisms and vegetation and animals and life as we know it on Earth. So what we're looking for is evidence for the very primitive life, single cell microorganisms, and there might be evidence for organic molecules associated with those organisms, minerals that those organisms might have produced, or evidence for fossils at the microscopic scale entombed in these rocks.
So are we talking about microbes made up of the same kind of DNA we have here on Earth, or would it be a different kind?
Well, we don't know. We'll be looking for organic molecules that we know make up life here on Earth. And we'll be looking eventually, once we get those rocks back here to Earth, we can look for things like DNA and carbon-based life forms. But, you know, this is an alien planet. We might be looking at life not as we know it, but life as we don't know it. And then it's going to be really hard for us to determine whether that is evidence for life if it's a form of life that we've never seen before.
So here's the other, perhaps touchier question. You're bringing this unknown substance back to Earth from an alien planet at a time when we're in a pandemic and people are really creeped out by any little fragments of any possible life form that may be floating around. I assume you have a rock solid sterility code at your lab.
Oh, absolutely. And these rocks aren't coming into my lab. These rocks, well, first of all, these rocks will be returned to Earth on a long timeline. Perseverance is really just laying the groundwork. It's going to be identifying the rocks that it wants to collect, drilling into those rocks, extracting sample cores, putting them into little sample tubes, hermetically sealing those tubes, and then leaving them on the surface of Mars. It's going to take another mission to follow up. That mission will launch no earlier than 2026. It will go to Mars, pick up those samples, and then launch them away from Mars into orbit. And it's going to take a third mission to go back to Mars into orbit, grab those samples from space, from orbit around Mars, and bring them all the way back to Earth.
Wow.
That whole thing is going to take 10 years. So we have some time to figure this out. And we are thinking in advance about how to protect the Earth from contamination from anything we bring back. And there will be very stringent laboratory protocols used. And we're also thinking very hard about how to protect these precious samples that we're bringing back from Mars so that they don't get contaminated with Earth life. If we find evidence for something biogenic, something indicating life in those Mars rocks, we want to make sure that we're not just detecting our own contaminations. So it's a two-way planetary protection that we're working with here. But we have, again, 10 years to work out all of those fine details.
And long term, as a geologist, are you strictly focused on finding the existence of life, or are you also talking about the possibility of mining the raw materials to actually, for example, create oxygen and rocket fuel so you can start actually launching rockets from Mars to even more distant places?
That's another exciting thing that this mission is going to do. It's going to help pave the way for eventual human exploration. And there will be an instrument on board the rover called MOXIE that's going to test a way of creating breathable oxygen from Mars's atmosphere. It's going to suck in carbon dioxide from Mars's air and then convert that into breathable oxygen. And molecular oxygen is also something that can be used for rocket fuel. So this might be a way for a robot to go to Mars ahead of the human missions. Maybe we send it there a couple of months before humans arrive, and it can sit there on the surface taking Mars air and converting it into breathable oxygen and converting it into rocket fuel so that when the humans arrive, their air tanks are full and ready to go. They don't have to bring all of their oxygen with them. And their fuel tanks for the return trip home are also filled up and ready to go.
Wait a second. If you've got a gizmo that can take CO2 and turn it into breathable oxygen, we need to set those things up right here, don't we?
We certainly could use some help here on Earth removing that additional CO2 from our atmosphere. But where we're talking about, the scales are so much different. It would be another thing altogether to try and do that on a planetary scale. We're talking about keeping just a couple human beings alive for a couple of years.
Gotcha. Well, that sounds really exciting. And just watching the people at JPL holding their breath and then waiting, you know, 22 minutes to get the signal back saying that everything was fine. That was quite a moment.
Oh, yeah. Just so much tension. And then to see the room erupt once they got the word that touchdown was soft and successful. Whew. What a day.
Dr. Melissa Rice is a professor of geology at Western Washington University. What an exciting time. Congratulations on being part of this very successful mission so far.
Thank you so much.
And there's more with Dr. Rice on our latest Ross File, which is available now wherever you get podcasts. Just Google Ross File and KIRO. That's pretty exciting. When you to imagine the number of lines of code, all the mechanics that have to go just right for something like that to work. And you saw what they did, right? They hover, they lower the thing down by a sky crane. It's got a little drone on it.
Really, it's incredible. I mean, the fact that it all went well that far away. I mean, are you kidding me? I failed that science class at the beginning of Code 1. Yeah, that was incredible.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
Our resident historian Felix Bunnell joins us every Friday for All Over the Map, which is a quick look at the stories behind the names of local places. And speaking of maps, Felix is barely on the same map as we are right now because he is thousands of miles from the northwest in the quiet rural area near Boston, which was once home to bustling shipyards with a direct connection to our Columbia River. Here he is.
Yeah, this story is about the North River, which is about 40 minutes south of Boston near the town of Scituate on what's called the South Shore. It was there in 1773 that a three-masted ship was built called the Columbia. Spoiler alert, it was 83 feet long and 24 feet wide. And it was on May 11th, 1792 that Robert Gray sailed that very same ship into the mouth of a big river along the northwest coast, a river that poor old Captain Vancouver had missed just a few weeks earlier. Captain Gray called it Columbia's River after his ship and claimed the land for the U.S. Now, if you went to the North River now, other than these wonderful historical markers that were put there in 1919, which oddly actually faced the river and not the road, you'd have no idea that the area was once home to more than a dozen shipyards along about 15 miles of river, from the 1640s to the 1870s, and that hundreds of wooden ships were built there. Now, the shipyards were located there because the North River was connected to the Atlantic Ocean and was close to Boston, and was relatively protected from wind and tides. But the main reason was probably the pine and oak trees that grew in great abundance along the river. Those were the raw materials of wooden ships in those days. I talked to a local named Caleb Estabrooks. He lives on the site of an old shipyard and has done a lot of exploring. With a metal detector, he and his family have found all kinds of old shipbuilding tools, including a 7-foot-long saw blade. And we have some amazing photos at My Northwest. Now, the Columbia is believed to have been built at Briggs Shipyard in the town of Norwell at a spot called Hobart's Landing. You know, and Caleb says there wasn't much to a shipyard in those days. He told me there's mostly stacks of raw materials and maybe a small building for storing tools and drawings. He also said that if you know where to look in certain spots when the tide is really low, you can still see what are called ways. Those are the big oak ramps that were used to slide finished hulls into the river. Now, I also talked to Scott Babcock. He turns 80 years old next month and has lived in Norwell along the river for 71 years. He loves it. He's known about the North River Columbia River connection for most of his life. And at his college reunion a few years ago, he asked an old classmate who lives in Oregon to do him a historic favor.
If I took some water from the North River and sent it to you, would you pour it into the Columbia River? And he said, no, but I'd have my wife do it, and I would take her picture while she's doing it because she's much better looking than I am. And I said, yes, that's true. She is much better looking.
And they followed through and did this and made this water connection between the two rivers. So I love that there are people like Caleb and people like Scott. I felt like I was among my people and talking to both of them. Final note, though it's currently closed by the pandemic, the sailing ship at Tom Sawyer's Island at Disneyland is a 1958 replica of the Columbia. So thanks to those guys. They shared some wonderful photos, and they're all at My Northwest.
So the Columbia has been officially baptized by water from Boston.
It's cross-country.
Tomorrow marks 1 month of the Biden administration. My question for Face the Nation host Margaret Brennan this morning, is the president's goal of 100 million vaccinations in 100 days still realistic?
Good question. It once again gets down to that last mile, and the federal government keeps saying they're getting more supply coming, but then it's distribution at the state level that continues to be a problem. So ironing that out, you had this public, not spat, but public statement, I would say, from the National Governors Association this week, 9 governors in particular who really pointed out to the president that they don't like some of the basic architecture of how this is being distributed within their states by the federal government in ways they think it could be improved. So that's a long way of saying that they're still working on trying to iron out the delivery mechanisms to make sure that they get to that goal of 100 million people by the end of April.
I keep hearing that eventually they're just going to send it to pharmacies. That would seem to be the most logical thing.
Yes.
But it hasn't happened.
And it is. I guess this is the difference, because I've gotten tangled in this in arguments with governors, even on air. So the federal government program technically does provide vaccine supply directly to pharmacies. That started last week. But here's the catch, and this is where it gets messy. It is the state and the county that's determining how many doses actually go and to whom they are available. So there's that middle ground area, that connective tissue is where it's kind of getting complicated. Others like Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former FDA commissioner, is a frequent guest on our program, say, take the states and the localities out of it. Just distribute this like you distribute a flu vaccine.
Yeah.
Give it to Walmart. Give it to CVS. Tell them, hey, get this out to customers where it's needed and where it's wanted. But, you know, there are others in public health who argue, no, you have to engineer this highly so that it gets to areas that are underserved in particular. Gottlieb and others would argue there's a way to do it all. But for the moment, it leaves the rest of us who do want to get a vaccine struggling with these systems, state by state, county by county. I mean, it's a mess.
I know. Do we know, is the reason for the delay the lack of supply, or is it just the poor organization?
It's a bit of both, and it frankly is different in each state in terms of how disorganized, organized they are. I mean, if you look at some of the rankings, it's Connecticut, it's West Virginia, it's North Dakota. There are states in there that are doing a good job of distributing and going about it differently. Some of them opting out of the federal programs. That's what West Virginia did. They didn't go by the federal guidelines on certain things. They used the National Guard. They didn't use CVS and Walgreens to get it into nursing homes. And their governor argues that's how they got it out to even in a rural state, even in a poor state, and hit a large percentage of their population. So it really, you know, it depends state by state how the performance is, and it's becoming inherently political in each location. But the Biden administration, in terms of what the federal government can control, they say they are securing more supply that's coming into the pipeline soon. And remember, we are staring down that late February deadline, or expected deadline, for the FDA to greenlight Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. So that would pump more supply into the pipeline too.
On the coronavirus relief package and when that's going to be passed, I guess negotiations are underway. There was a lot of hope this was going to be a big bipartisan thing. Is it going to get any Republican support?
Well, that's still being negotiated behind the scenes. We know the Biden administration, the president at least, has said or signaled that the $15 minimum wage provision is likely to get stripped out. In terms of securing key Democrats like West Virginia's Joe Manchin or Republicans who might sign on to this, we don't have clear names and numbers yet. It's still a fight behind the scenes.
Mario Brennan, the host of CBS's Face the Nation. This is Seattle's Morning News. And joining me now is the president of the Washington Education Association, Larry Delaney. And, of course, the question for you, Larry, is with the CDC saying it's safe for teachers to go back into the classroom, even if unvaccinated, is the union going to support that?
Well, I think we are glad that the CDC has released this guidance, and certainly we support the CDC guidelines. I think it's important to recognize that although they said vaccinations are not required, they did also say that that educators should be prioritized in the process, and certainly that's something that we continue to advocate for here in Washington.
So where do you stand now? Do you get your own category as teachers or not?
Well, so educators right now are prioritized based on age, and educators who are 65 and over are eligible to get a vaccine. And so, you know, we believe the prioritization should be based on whether they're currently working in an in-person setting or not, mm-hmm. rather than their age.
Makes sense. So who have you communicated that to? Have you talked to the governor about it?
We've had dialogue back and forth, and think the governor has made his position very clear that he believes that vaccinations should be prioritized based on age. And he has reiterated that many times. We disagree. We believe that prioritization should be given to educators working in person.
Okay, so what does that mean? Will the union then recommend the teachers not return to school if they are told to?
Well, those are local decisions. I don't know that we've seen any local union anywhere in the state double down on that line in the sand, but certainly, certainly our members, like society, is split on this issue. We've got members who adamantly believe that it's not safe to return to in-person teaching and learning until there's a vaccine. We've got educators who believe that it can be safe given all of the other mitigation strategies. And I think that's one of the points that also has to be considered, is that there's still school districts in our state that are having debates around what 6 feet means. There's still districts in our state that are struggling with getting the personnel in place to clean and disinfect on a regular basis. And, you know, we don't see comprehensive testing. We know that there's struggles all over the state with contact tracing, and we know that many of our buildings don't have adequate ventilation. Because of that, we should then make sure that educators are prioritized to provide that additional layer of security and protection, not only for themselves, but for their students, for the families that those students go home to, and for their communities.
So what is the plan at present, as you understand it, for getting back to in-person learning?
Well, I think right now, Dave, all but 6 districts in the state have some form of in-person teaching mm-hmm. and learning that's taking place.
Okay, so suppose a district decides to go back to in-person learning and says teachers will be expected to report. What should the policy be if an individual teacher decides that he or she does not feel that it's safe enough to go back?
Well, we're certainly advocating and working with school districts and local union leaders to establish policies and procedures that would allow for an educator who does not feel safe to continue to work in a distance learning environment. There's mm-hmm. a certain percentage of students and families as well that don't feel comfortable going I saw one survey yesterday that indicated roughly 25% of families uncertain whether or not they want their students, their children, to return to in-person teaching and learning. You know, in an ideal situation, we'd be able to match those educators who also are not comfortable with the return with those students. That presents all sorts of logistical challenges. We realize that would involve separating students from their current teachers. We recognize that there's challenges with that as well. But across the state, locals are working with districts to ensure that options are available for those educators who don't feel comfortable going back in person.
So your suggestion is that it be a matter of choice, both on the part of the students and the teachers.
Yes. In a perfect world, you know, that would be ideal.
Are school districts willing to accept that?
Some are, and there's plans in place in which districts are really going above and beyond to create those opportunities. You know, certainly not happening in all districts.
So do you, as the head of the union, have a set of guidelines that you think would be an acceptable level of protection, I guess? Because it seems kind of squishy. Parents are really hot to get their kids back into school, and I think that if it turns out a lot of teachers are not willing to go back, that's going to cause some real tensions in the school districts.
Oh, it's, you know, without a doubt. And there is increasing political pressure to get all schools, you know, back to, you know, what I would put, if you could see me in air quotes, normal. I don't know that we're going to get back to what people consider to be normal anytime soon, you know, but certainly there's some challenges related to that. And, you know, what we are simply encouraging is, first of all, that those CDC guidelines are met, that the social distancing is there. And, you know, if I could just for a second, it seems, I think, to many people that, well, it's a simple concept. Have kids 6 feet apart, wear masks, clean regularly, but essentially decisions to reopen and how that looks has been farmed out to just shy of 300 school districts to figure out what works best for them. You know, essentially we get 300 different variations on a theme, and we've got districts that can't agree what 6 feet means. Cleaning and sanitation is a challenge. Ventilation is a challenge. Testing is a challenge. Tracing is a challenge. And with all of those challenges out there, you know, we believe strongly that educators need to be prioritized for a vaccine, and it's doable. We're talking right now about 30,000 educators, roughly, who are currently working in person, and we believe that that's a very doable number. The governor disagrees with us.
On the wider issue, the fact that kids have lost, well, close to a year of schooling, are your members prepared to make that up, or does that have to be just written off?
Oh, no. I think there's many people who look and think, well, if you just added, you know, a couple of weeks, if we went during the summer, if we extended the next school year. And what I would really ask people to do is just allow educators to do what they do best, and that is to educate. Yeah, I'm confident that over time our students will be fine. But I think it also needs to be pointed out that as we do get more and more returning to some form of in-person teaching and learning, you know, we've heard an awful lot about the challenges that many students are facing in the remote learning or being at home for a considerable period of time. And we need to ensure also that schools have the resources to deal with all of the issues that students are going to be bringing back to school with them. And, you know, so we're strongly advocating for more counselors, more social workers within schools, more healthcare professionals within schools to provide those services that we know our students are going to need at a greater level when they return.
Larry Delaney is the president of the Washington Education Association. Thank you, Larry. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Dave.
It's time for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Mike Novak and listwithnovak.com. Four sisters in New Jersey have been busy in their kitchen cooking up a recipe to end racial justice with challah bread. CBS's Nikki Batiste introduces us to the Challah Back Girls.
The four Loftman sisters didn't expect to find themselves where they started as little girls, in their parents' kitchen baking challah, a Jewish bread.
We fall into that group of Jews who learned how to bake challah when we were really young. It's eaten ceremonially on the Sabbath, Friday evening.
When the pandemic pushed college classes and jobs online, Marnie, Sarah, and Hannah headed home to Teaneck, New Jersey to spend time with their parents and youngest sister, Eliana.
Challah has its own symbolism.
It's traditionally a braided bread. So with each strand of bread, we're kind of reminded that we're all unified and that we're all connected somewhere, somehow.
Initially, the sisters decided to donate loaves to frontline workers in their hometown. But a few weeks later, news of George Floyd's death sparked a second idea.
We want freedom for all black and oppressed people.
We all attended, the four of us, the Black Lives Matter protests that took place in Teaneck, and that was a really pivotal moment for us.
The Challah Back Girls were born. The sisters began selling loaves of their challah and donating profits to different organizations committed to racial equity and social justice.
This really was a project that was inspired by the moment because we were home, because there was this attention to all these different issues.
When we're actively baking the challah, there's a traditional blessing that we say called the Hafrish. When I do that blessing, I try to think of the people around the world who need that healing and who need that prayer.
So far, the Challah Back Girls have given away nearly $50,000 to 14 organizations, including the B3 Foundation, a nonprofit providing educational tools and scholarships to under-resourced children. It was founded by Pittsburgh Steeler Zach Banner. He posted this video tasting the sisters' challah.
That is fire.
It's literally a group of sisters baking and working and sweating and doing all these things for a good cause. But it's just such a small gesture. It's so easy to do.
How many states have you now sent your challah to?
We're at 42 states.
Wow.
And over 300 cities.
This is Zach Banner's favorite.
Spreading a love of challah, one loaf at a time.
It's dangerously good.
For CBS This Morning, I'm Nikki Batiste in Teaneck, New Jersey.
I saw some of their bread on their Facebook page, and it is very beautiful. It looks like some premium pastries, but it's challah.
I hear you have some premium pastries in the newsroom this morning.
We do. Yeah, G brought some donuts in for Fresh Friday, and it's a double-decker box. I usually have two of them, and today I'm really trying to have zero.
That is the one problem with working from home.
Yes.
No donuts from G on Friday. And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here is G. Scott, I've heard wonderful things about the donuts you brought this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Really
oh, yeah.
Sorry I can't be there.
Sully, you get one, bro?
No. It's Lent. I'm trying really hard to be
right,
good.
It's Lent.
Mm. Yeah. Sorry, Dave. I'll get you some tuna
You're
fish.
Off the donuts?
You did.
Are you off the hamburgers, too?
No. Well, it's Friday. So, yeah. So, no meat for me. But, yeah.
So, I mean, did you see the bacon on top of the maple bar?
No, I didn't really take a good look because I knew I'd be tempted.
Yeah. It was with bacon.
The devil shows up in mysterious ways.
Yeah. Or it could be something better, you know?
Yeah. You know what? It's going to be hard to pass those up. They look good.
Yeah. What's up, Dave? What we got, bro?
Mars, man.
Oh, I nerded out yesterday. I felt like a kid all over again. I was all on top of that, and here's why. I'm so curious, like so many people are as well, of if there ever was ancient life there on Mars. And also the discovery, the thing that they're going to possibly find there. And so I think that there's going to be possibly so many answers to some questions that we've had. And then what's going to happen is we're going to have more questions while they're there. I'm super excited about this, Dave. Were you excited, man?
Absolutely. Well, I grew up during the original space program and nerded out on, watching tiny black and white TVs and Walter Cronkite and the whole thing. So I've been a big fan of this, but I'm trying to figure out what the scenarios might be. Because these planets are billions of years old.
I know.
And when the people who evolved on Mars saw that their atmosphere was going south, don't you think they probably burrowed deep underground and are still there?
That could be a possibility. Or, you're there and it's like, we're going to maybe find out why they are buried underground. What if there was something that was there? Like, I know, and I'm not trying to be funny here because I'm going to be serious. Like, here we are dealing with a global pandemic here on Earth. I mean, who knows what's going on up there on Mars? Maybe there's some stuff there that we don't want to bring back, Dave.
I was talking with one of the scientists who's in charge of the geology and selecting which rock samples to take. Uh-huh. And they're essentially looking for fossilized remains of ancient life. But who knows, first of all, what would be defined as life on Mars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not typical DNA, who's to say that whatever life is there follows our time scale? So time is what we make of it in terms of our own lifespans. But it might be a life form that is much smaller and has a much longer lifespan and may just simply look inert. We might not even know what we're looking at.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right about that. And speaking about that, like yesterday, I sent over to Ursula and Chef, and we get ready to do our show. Today on our show at 9:30, we're actually going to have a guest. An astronaut is going to be on our show. So I'm going to ask him so many questions. And you know, I guess like you said, like you, back in the day, Walter Cronkite, black and white TV, way to set that stage and that image. Yesterday, seeing those in the control room just get up there and celebrate, I was just thinking for a moment, like, I get excited about, you know, football and a touchdown and Super Bowls. Like, yo, that was probably the Super Bowl times 10 in that moment, in that room, to success for that to happen. And it was one of those things where I wish I was there.
Well, in a way, it's the world's longest touchdown pass, right?
Ooh, well done.
Huh?
Yeah, and it took 7 months to get there. And so that just lets you know, 7 months at some point, I mean, you got to wonder in the future, will it get shorter, you know, as far as time getting there? Dave, would you ever want to go in space ever if you had the means and opportunity to do so?
I'll tell you strangely about, I guess, a couple of years after I arrived, when they had the space shuttle, they were looking for journalist volunteers to go into space. And I actually applied for it, didn't get it, which might have been fortunate because I think that was right before the Challenger disaster.
Yeah.
But it turned out, I found out later, I have a balance problem, and I do not do very well in any kind of anti-gravity situation. I was one of those NATO trainers. Dory and I had a dogfight in these actual planes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, I lost all feeling in my extremities, and along with whatever meal I'd had that day. And I was literally paralyzed once they started doing the barrel rolls and stuff. So I would have been a very, very bad astronaut.
Hey, Dave, do you think that you have that because of what happened, you know, years ago when you're telling me about those kids in the hallways that used to grab you by your shorts?
I never got grabbed by the shorts. I got grabbed by the loop in the back of my shirt.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
very,
different experience.
Did your
underwear make it up to your neck?
They didn't do that then, G. It was a kinder, gentler time.
Oh.
Plus they tracked us. So I was in the same class with all the other physics nerds.
I mean,
none of them even knew how to do that.
In all fairness, though, today that wouldn't be tolerated. But
I know.
But years ago, but funny, bullying was tolerated. Dodgeball was tolerated.
Oh, dodgeball. I got nailed in dodgeball all the time.
Happy Friday, brother.
Happy Friday. We'll see you at 9. G and Ursula, 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.